This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hi, this is Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note on Rabble.ca. I'm Ellie Gordon Marshall. Want a musician that can rock your socks, shake your groove thing, make you cry and then laugh? Alida Kinney Starr's tapestry of sounds can take you there. She started off hip-hop, then she left the scene because she says she didn't fit in. She then moved on to rock, but also felt like she didn't fit in there. It's probably because she's the kind of artist that lives in the borderlands. She creates a genre unto herself. The young artist will be one of the performers at the 30th anniversary of the Women's Worlds Conference in Ottawa-Gatineau in early July. The conference is a global convergence to advance women's equality through research, exchange, leadership, and action. Rabble caught up with Starr recently to get her thoughts on the direction of the women's movement and what she's hoping to expect from the conference in July.
You've been on the music scene for many years now, and you're famous for your innovative genre blending, and I love that your Facebook page describes your music as Run DMC meets Joni Mitchell. So yeah, I think that's great. But so can you talk about your latest evolution with your most recent album, A Different Day?
Yeah, that record, I think it's about exactly a year old now, and that record was, at a certain point a few years ago, I got really, really tired of the hip-hop scene, like all the fronting and all the posturing, primarily the posturing through fashion and language. So I was just like, you know what, fuck this, I'm gonna make a rock record. Mm-hmm. so that's what A Different Day came out of. It was just like, I wanted to have an instrument on stage rather than, like, because when I'm rapping it's usually just beats or I'm doing poetry, and I didn't really feel like I really fit into the hip hop scene, but just because I don't really use the language and the posturing that is predominant in hip hop culture. But that said, like when I put that record out, A Different Day, I also found I don't really fit into the rock scene either. Mm. So, it was kind of like a defeated effort in a way. I also found, this is kind of like just sheer practicality, but it got really expensive because I was traveling with my guitar and my amp.
Yeah.
And airlines don't like guitars. So it was like, some airlines will ding you, some won't, but like some airlines will charge you to bring a guitar, even to bring it onto the plane. So it didn't really work, basically. It didn't really work to my benefit. And also, I found I kind of alienated a lot of my fans, because, like, a lot of my fans, they come to my shows because they want to, like, boogie and stuff.
Yeah.
And,
What's the difference in the dynamics from, like, a live show that's kind of rock-oriented versus your older hip-hop freestyle?
Well, the music industry is at an all-time standstill as far as the economy of it goes, so I don't often tour with my band anymore. I only tour with my band when I'm getting paid real money, because they deserve real money, and I'm not really willing to take them out for, like, petty change. So I end up touring solo a lot, and with the guitar songs, I mean, it's very emotional music and people do like it, but I do find, like, the music that I'm working on now and about to release, it's a whole body of hip-hop, but it's kind of like new wavy hip-hop. It's really synth-driven, and it's a lot easier to work with on stage, because I think people go to music events largely for a release, and I like serving that platform, you know, and giving people a chance to relax more. Like the guitar record, A Different Day, it was so emotional. Those songs are so emotional that I felt like I shouldn't really be putting people through my emotional shit on stage.
I hear ya. It's interesting what you say about hip hop and the posturing that goes on there. And I mean, hip hop itself has gone through many evolutions in the past couple of decades. But what was it like when you first kind of stepped into the scene in the mid 90s? Like, I imagine there weren't many women rapping at the freestyle nights.
No, there weren't. And when I entered the music business, I entered it through the back door of art. So I didn't have any illusions, and I still don't really have illusions about like global domination. Like, there are artists that know when they start music, they're like, I want to do music because I want to be famous. But when I entered the music world, it was like, I was still thinking art. So when I was rapping and when I was in that scene and stuff, I was still using it as the same, using it as a similar vehicle as I was using my art for, which was primarily for confrontation and controversy and discussion. So it was pretty cool coming into the world of rap music in the late 90s and mid 90s, because even though there weren't a lot of women on the scene, there were still a lot of poets, especially in New York. There were a lot of people that were doing poetry for poetry. And like, you don't see, I mean, there's kind of like a separation. There's like the spoken world and then the rap world. But in the 90s, it was the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, No, I was gonna say that's a really interesting point, and especially in the 90s, especially the earlier 90s, the female MC hadn't been packaged in the same way I think it is now.
No.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, like, if you listen to, say, I've been listening to this old record that I have, Dream Warriors, the Subliminal, whatever it's called, the record with Day In and Day Out on it. I think it's their second or third record, and they've got this really great female poet on there, and she's talking about sexuality, but she's not pandering to the camera the way female sexuality panders to camera now. And I could go on and on and on about this, but it's a pretty sad time, I think, for the commodification of female sexuality in media. It's everywhere. It's kind of like just one message going out to a billion trillion people.
Mm-hmm. I know. Yeah. Thanks to, I mean, while the internet has really opened up the world in good ways, in other ways, you know, Lady Gaga is a complex character and people have different opinions about her, but her videos have been watched by a billion people, which is insane. But
I know.
Yeah, so the influence is undeniable about these kind of messages, like you said. So,
and if you look at what sells, like, you don't really see, like, let's think about like someone like Missy Elliott, who was like a pretty big figurehead in the hip hop world, you know, say 10 or 8 years ago. And think about her videos, like the amount of like authenticity, and I would say she's very sexy. And but if you look at the difference between her and someone like Lady Gaga or Miley Cyrus or Beyoncé, the expression is I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound really jaded, but I don't see enough diversity in the female expression anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, Missy's videos were awesome because they were so, first of all, they were so weird. There's a lot of stuff going on, and like, there's a lot of dancing, like really creative dancing, but dancing from people who looked really different. Like, there'd be children, she'd be dancing, all that kind of stuff.
Right?
Yeah, so I feel that, and you don't really see that anymore.
No, the choreography was tight and athletic and funky and spirited, and most of the choreography we see now is really tailored to the whole like bootylicious booty dancing, and I know I'm not saying it's not an athletic form, but come on, there's more to choreography than shaking your fucking ass.
Yeah, yeah. And at my local community center, the only kind of women's only dance night they have is to learn how to dance like a pussycat doll.
Totally.
Yeah, so that's the direction.
But, yeah, and even, you know what, even in health clubs, there's like pole dancing classes.
Yeah, yeah, stripper size.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, to bring it back down to kind of the I mean, because the origin of hip hop is pretty political and from the streets. And I know I've read that you wrote that when you started rhyming, it kind of helped you to talk about huge questions about the way society is structured and how that became a bit clearer to you. And you also had mentioned somewhere I read that the kind of wordplay helped you talk about your relation to your ancestry. So I'm wondering how that evolution has been and how that's like hip hop and music in general has led you to a better appreciation and awareness of your Aboriginal ancestry.
I would say that is an evolving state of being. And it is true that like I feel really fortunate that I have the vehicle of songwriting, you know, to clarify my worldview, like songwriting on guitar, but also like songwriting for poetry and rap music. Because when I was younger, like I remember being a little tiny girl and I was pretty dark. Like the sun would hit, my mom used to call me her little black berry, and like her little like brown as a berry and stuff. Cause when I was little compared to my brothers, like the sun would hit me and I would be just like chocolate colored in an hour. And so when I was really little, I didn't really have so many questions about being mixed race. But then, you know, that time like in high school and stuff where I was like, okay, I'm white because like I don't want to tell people my dad is brown. And then when I started writing music and kind of like started traveling around, even before I started writing music, when I was just doing art and I was traveling around, I started to think about it a lot. And it was mostly because, you know, like people always ask, they're like, oh, what are you or where are you from? Those kind of questions. And I think it would be unfair to say that I've got that shit figured out, because I don't. Like, it, you know, I still have days where I feel like I have no right to, you know, to talk about being brown because I'm so white, you know, and I write about that. I write about being brown and being Native from a position of strength and a position of challenge and question, but it doesn't mean that I've got it dialed. You know, it's just like, it's still my life journey. Like I think I'll still probably swing back and forth through my lifetime and go through periods of time where like, okay, I guess I'm white. Like, even though I have Native blood, maybe I'm just white. And then I'll probably go back into, you know, feeling like, you know what, fuck you, I'm a fucking Indian. Like, and just because I'm also white doesn't mean I'm not a part of the national picture of our indigenous population or the global picture of an indigenous population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Like, I don't have it figured out, man.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the strength of a good role model is admitting that. Admitting that, because, I mean, that's the way life is, right? It is ever evolving. And if you stop trying to figure things out, then I think that's a defeat in itself.
Thanks. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, but I wanted to say that what's interesting and like being someone who's in the limelight that I imagine would be kind of a benefit and a curse to it is that you get to represent some of the diversity within the Aboriginal population that gets totally sidelined by the media, which really tries to simplify it. But at the same time, you're probably asked to, same with like any person of color, asked to kind of represent their population.
You nailed it. And that's the point that feels fraudulent to me sometimes, because I am kind of held up as like an Indigenous artist, and I do feel at odds with that title sometimes, even though, like, you know, I can look at my dad and, you know, he's brown, you know, it's like, there's no question to me on like a spiritual and like an internal, like from inside, but on the outside, like, it does feel hard sometimes to hold that up, because my life picture is so much, like, I've had so many opportunities that a lot of my native peers haven't had. And I feel like, I just feel like, fuck, I can't speak for you, you know, like, your life is so much more rooted in an understanding of what it means to be Native in Canada, because my understanding is more like, you know, I wasn't raised on a reservation, so it's like I don't understand a lot of things that my Native friends understand amongst each other. Mm-hmm. You know, and that makes me feel sad sometimes, because I feel sad and I feel pressure that I'm supposed to, like, speak for other Native people. And I'm like, fuck, I don't know everybody's history and, like, what we all think. Like, I can only speak for myself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not comfortable being, like, a flag, you know. I'm comfortable holding up the flag, but I'm not comfortable being the fucking flag or a token or anything like that. But it's just the way the media works, where I get written up that way all the time, and I'm like, fuck, I never said that. Like, I never, ever said that I wasn't who I am, but the media just has a way of, they take one thing and they just pump it out there. Like, that's the only thing about me that's interesting, and it's really irritating.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, we live in this strange time where, like, Aboriginal history is pretty invisible in North America, and on the one hand, so there's not diverse representations in media, but on the other hand, there's this disturbing trend I've noticed where, like, Aboriginal symbolism and headdresses has become kind of trendy.
Totally.
So it's
totally
this bizarre thing that's going on, and really confusing and kind of insulting.
It's really insulting, and on that note, I do feel proud of, like, representing mixed blood people and Native people. Like, I count Natives and mixed bloods together, and I do feel proud, because I'm like, well, fuck, at least, like, I've had lots and lots and lots of young people, young kids and teens and stuff, write me and be like, you know what, I'm so happy that you're doing your thing. So those, then it makes sense to be viewed publicly and for people to know that I'm mixed, right? But it's like, if I was not a musician and viewed publicly, that would be simply my private battle.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be, like, you know, on display.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's an interesting line you have to toe, for sure. So the coming up this July and early July is the Women's World Conference, and it's a gathering that takes place every 3 years, and it's going to be the first time it's been held in Canada in its 30-year history. Wow. And you are performing at it. So are you excited? What are you expecting from this event?
I'm really excited, because it's not very often that I get to be around a dominantly female environment, inside a dominantly female environment. And then also, it's like, I'm assuming that there's going to be a lot of scholars and a lot of interesting conversation, and I really need to be around other women, like, because this the music business is a fucking boys' club. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around it. So events like this are just like, they're like, I've been looking forward to this for however long I've had the booking, which has probably been a couple months, and it's another month till I actually get to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty excited too. And Tanya Tagak is also performing, who I
she
think
is?
You've yeah.
She's my friend.
I was gonna say I you two have performed together before,
yeah.
Have you?
Yeah. We're friends. We've been friends for a long time.
Yeah, she's an amazing performer. I saw her recently. Oh my gosh.
I know.
Yeah. So that should be great. Well, what's interesting too is the main theme of the Women's World Conference of 2011 is inclusions, exclusions, and seclusions, living in a globalized world. And I was reading that one of the focuses is talking about evolving identities in the face of this globalization, which is kind of central to a lot of what you explore. And it's interesting, I was checking out Beat Nation, which you're involved yeah. with, and they, on the main site on their webpage, they talk about, so they're a group that works with the development of hip-hop culture with Aboriginal youth, and on their webpage, they immediately address the concern that a project like this could lead youth away from tradition and towards the mainstream. But Beat Nation says that using hip-hop is actually more of a vessel for youth to rediscover First Nations culture. Mm. So I like that, and I think it really relates to the theme of talking about globalization and kind of the negatives and the benefits of having this kind of world that we're growing in. And one of the interesting ways I think Beat Nation talks about this is specifically with, yeah, to use tools like hip-hop to empower Aboriginal youth. So I'm wondering, what is your experience with this group?
Beat Nation is the creation of a friend of mine's who's a very, very good artist, visual artist. She's maybe more of an acquaintance, but I would count her as a friend. Her name's Tanya Willard, and I think that she originated the concept, but I mean, I could be mistaken in that, but I've written a few pieces for Beat Nation about, like, probably over, I think, 7 years or something, about my take on hip-hop and my own Indigenous identity. And I think that, I mean, I've written about this and I still agree with the thesis that, like, I mean, the drum, like in a modern sense, the drum and drum culture and powwow culture before it was used as like a, you know, a selling tool and a way to win awards and money and stuff, like the drum and powwow and gathering together over the drum is a solidifying concept. Like it does bring people together, and I believe that rhythm is healing. And because, like, we're in a modern and digital age, hip hop has a potential to heal people. And like, I travel quite a lot through schools in BC. I work for sometimes for this organization called Art Starts in Schools, and I get the luxury of talking to kids a little bit about hip hop and how hip hop was storytelling and still can be storytelling. Like, it doesn't just have to be what it's become, and the act and the rite of passage of, like, using rhythmic structure to tell a story is a really old ritual, and it's an Indigenous ritual, but it's also, like, African American and it's pagan too. I mean, like, rhyming poetry and old poets like Yeats and English poets and stuff, like that act of storytelling to a beat is, I believe it's, you know, if we practice that we clarify our worldview. And so for Native people, I think that's fundamental, because like so many so many natives are urban natives now, and it's like they're not necessarily practicing traditions. A lot of natives are listening to rock and roll and blues and rap music, and yeah, I stand by the thesis that hip hop is kind of like new powwow for a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really, really great way to put it. And I just have one more question. And yeah, so through the lens of your ongoing work, where do you think, in your opinion, feminism and the women's movement is going to go in the next 20 years?
I don't know, because I get worried that, like, we're just walking backwards sometimes. Like, the predominance of pornography in our minds from the access to porn through the internet. Porn and, like, the whole pussycat dolls, like, stripper dancing and everything. Sometimes it feels like we are walking backwards.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a one step forward, two steps back.
And I mean, I know a lot of feminists say that, like, I have friends who work in the sex trade, and they're like, no, fuck you, star, like, this is my power. And I know that argument, but I disagree with it. And I think that, like, I just think we're in trouble right now, actually. And I don't know what it's going to look like in 20 years. And I wish I had a more optimistic perspective, but I really don't feel optimistic about women and girls' relationship, the relationship that we currently have to our sexuality. I don't feel optimistic about it, because as long as popular culture and pornography dominate our minds, which they do, I think we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say I largely agree with you. And when we're living in a time where things that are being claimed to be empowering for girls and women are the exact replications of stuff that we realized was really degrading and objectifying 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like this repackaging of what's liberating is really disturbing.
Yeah.
And really confusing for young girls. So
yeah, it's crazy. Like, when I play shows, I often invite people to get up on stage and dance with me. Like, especially if it's like outdoor, like festivals in the summer. And I've had girls, I mean, I've had little tiny girls, and I'm talking like 7 years and under, get up on stage, and they already know all the pussycat dolls' erotic dancing moves, and that is how they dance at 5 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before they even have a concept of what sexuality possibly can mean to them.
Yeah.
They're imitating.
And they're watching Lady Gaga and Beyonce and all those videos, because that's all they can, that's what they see. And they're just learning how to be as provocative as they can. And they're, so what the fuck's that going to look like in 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's more than ever, I'm glad that this conference is going to happen in Canada, and to see what everyone has to say about it, because we have some pretty big thinkers that are coming in for this conference to talk about all these kind of things, and from many generations too, it looks like. So.
I'm so excited, I'm so excited about this conference.
And it's multiple days. So
I know, it's there's just so much like, oh, it's going to be the highlight of my year, basically.
That was Alita Kinney Starr speaking with myself, Ellie Gordon-Marshall of the Rabble Podcast Network. The interview took place on May the 31st of 2011. This is Needs No Introduction on Rabble.ca. Fresh ideas from speakers of note. Thanks for listening.